It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're following up this morning on the first executives to face criminal charges related to the subprime mortgage crisis. The FBI made the arrests yesterday. Hours later in Washington, the Justice Department and the FBI announced the arrests of more than 400 real estate industry players in a nationwide crackdown on mortgage fraud. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston reports the feds are trying to send a very specific message.
FBI officials let reporters on the street know the defendants were coming with a whistle. With that cue, two former Bear Stearns hedge fund managers, Ralph Chioffi and Matthew Tanin, were paraded before cameras in handcuffs from the FBI's New York offices to a waiting car. Then they were taken to a Brooklyn courthouse for processing. Their arrest and the unsealing of the indictment that accuses them of misleading investors was the beginning of a day that the FBI wanted to be all about mortgage fraud. Attorneys for Chioffi and Tanin had begged federal officials to allow their clients to surrender quietly. Officials said no. Could they avoid the perp walk? That was non-negotiable, too. Then hours later, FBI Director Robert Mueller and Deputy Attorney General Mark Philip had another announcement.
Today we're here to announce the results of a nationwide law enforcement sweep aimed at investigating and prosecuting mortgage fraud. In 3.5 months' time, this action, known as Operation Malicious Mortgage, has resulted in charges against more than 400 individual defendants.
He said on Wednesday alone they arrested 60 people on mortgage fraud charges, and the arrests, he said, would continue through the week. FBI Director Robert Mueller, so infamous for his desire to keep a low profile that his staff says he actually strikes out the words, "I want to announce," from any speech they hand to him, was front and center, promising more arrests to come.
We will follow up, we will investigate, and we will prosecute, and justice will be done. And consequently, I will expect that you will see additional times where we come before you and say, these are the number of cases we've investigated, and these are the results of those investigations.
The message was clear. The Department of Justice and the FBI wanted to stress they aren't just fighting terrorism.
Our objective, as always, is to protect the consumer and to stabilize the economic markets.
And then, in case any of this was lost on the people involved in the more than 1,400 mortgage fraud cases the FBI has opened in recent months, Mueller signaled that there could be more prosecutions related to the subprime mortgage crisis.
To persons who are involved in such schemes, we will find you. You will be investigated and you will be prosecuted. To those who would contemplate misleading, engaging in such schemes, you will spend time in jail.
The men who started the morning with a perp walk, Bear Stearns, Chioffi, and Tanin, were arraigned yesterday afternoon. They were charged with conspiracy and securities and wire fraud. Prosecutors say they lied to investors in a hedge fund heavily exposed to bonds linked to mortgage-backed securities. They painted a rosy picture of its prospects just weeks before the funds went belly up. Investors lost $1.6 billion. Chioffi and Tanin both pleaded not guilty to the charges and are out on bail. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, New York.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Officials close to a major FBI investigation into the mortgage crisis say two former Bear Stearns hedge fund managers will likely be indicted today for securities fraud. The two men will either be arrested or permitted to turn themselves into the authorities tomorrow. For more on this, we're joined now by NPR's Dina Temple-Raston. She's in New York. Dina, can you tell us a little bit more about this story?
Yeah, the FBI announced about 9 months ago that it was investigating more than a dozen Wall Street firms to see if they'd done anything illegal with regard to the mortgage crisis. And one of the things they were looking at was whether investors had been misled. So there's a grand jury meeting in New York right now as we speak, and we've learned that from people close to the case that the grand jury is going to sign indictments against two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers, a man named Ralph Chioffi and Matthew Tanin, and accuse them of securities fraud.
And these two men, what did they do?
Well, investigators allege that they were painting a rosy picture to investors about the prospects of their two funds. And these two funds had a lot of exposure to bonds backed by these low and subprime mortgages. But apparently, privately in emails, they were saying they were worried about the prospects for the funds. Now, what's unclear at this point is how much more there is to this story, because the indictments are still sealed. So some people close to the investigation said that their concern was the same concern that everyone had in the markets, that these two fund managers, there was a lot of volatility, and so they were concerned about that volatility. Others are saying that they were saying one thing to investors and saying quite another internally, and that amounted to securities fraud.
And what happened with these Bear Stearns funds? They eventually collapsed?
Yes, these were the ones that made all the headlines. They were the first ones to collapse, actually to the tune of $1.6 billion, B as in boy, to investors. And why this is important is the collapse of those funds set off alarm bells about how Wall Street firms were valuing their mortgage-backed securities. And then we saw that series of write-downs from lots of Wall Street firms. We've seen this in the headlines since then, as began taking a second look at their mortgage security holdings and trying to figure out what they were exactly worth.
Dina, the way you describe this situation, you hear about these executives saying everything's okay, everything's fine, when in fact everything really wasn't okay. You know, it sounds to me a little bit like the situation with Enron not too long ago. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, at Enron, you're right that there were a lot of executives who were saying one thing to their employees and to their shareholders, and meanwhile they were dumping stock like crazy before the price of the stock went down. That's not exactly what's happening here. What happened here was there's sort of a grayer area as to whether or not if people are talking privately about their concerns within the company, does that mean that you have to tell investors if you're bearish on Tuesday that now you're bullish on Friday? I mean, clearly during volatile markets, part of a hedge fund manager's job is to worry about whether or not the fund is doing well. So this is a little bit grayer in that respect.
Dina, back to these two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers. What happens next?
Well, the indictments will remain sealed until tomorrow, and that's when Cioffi and Tannen will either be arrested or they'll be allowed to turn themselves in. Now, there's some talk that there's going to be a perp walk of sorts when the two are transferred from FBI headquarters in Manhattan to the courthouse. You know these perp walks where people are in handcuffs and they sort of walk to the cars. You know, because these are such high-level Wall Street indictments related to the mortgage crisis and the highest-level ones to come down so far, I wouldn't be surprised if we see media there to see them walk to the cars, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was a press conference tomorrow from the U.S. attorney here in New York talking more about the charges.
NPR's Dina Temple-Raston joining us from New York. Thank you, Dina.
You're welcome.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The news yesterday that Tiger Woods needs season-ending surgery was a jolt to a lot of sports fans. And it's all the more reason to savor his final performance of 2008 at Monday's U.S. Open playoff. Many people did savor that moment. As NPR's Tom Goldman reports, Woods' sudden-death playoff win wasn't just compelling, it was a communal sports experience.
They paused at the New York Stock Exchange. CNBC reported that trading dipped almost 10% Monday during the U.S. Open playoff. Across the country, at a high-tech company called Mentor Graphics outside of Portland, Oregon, Charlie Brow paused on his way to get lunch.
As I was walking by the TV, there were approximately between 20 and 30 people watching Rocco Mediate and Tiger Woods compete in the playoff.
As Tiger lines up a birdie.
Charlie Brow says standing with that group of workmates around the big screen watching the NBC telecast was like being next to the green at the Open.
As soon as the Tiger or Rocco got ready to make the shot, it would become silent. You know, it's almost like someone was in here with a sign saying quiet.
And then when Tiger, I guess on 18, when he sank the putt that would get him, that tied him, yeah. Right, what was the reaction?
There was a roar.
There's the birdie he needed.
From coast to coast, in workplaces and bars and restaurants and other places where people can gather, they did, and they watched in record numbers. ESPN televised the first part of Monday's playoff, and the network said it was the most watched golf telecast in the history of cable TV. Golf websites reported record traffic. Beyond numbers was the buzz about Tiger versus Rocco. Emails and text messages, phone calls, breathless conversations. Did you see it? Could you believe it? Syracuse University professor Robert Thompson teaches about television and culture. He measures this kind of shared experience with what he calls a cultural rating. For Monday's playoff, Thompson says that rating was sky high.
What's interesting about it is this wasn't the Super Bowl that we kind of have planned all year long that we're going to do. This was a golfer. This was a genre of sports that we don't normally think of as having this huge, undifferentiated mass audience.
In the early 1980s, the audience began splintering when cable gave us choice and variety in what sports we watched. Since then, it's taken very special moments and individuals to glue our distracted, divided culture back together. Tiger Woods hobbling on a wounded knee, narrowly vanquishing an appealing 45-year-old foe, was one of those moments, says Robert Thompson.
In an odd sort of way, the way people gathered around the TV set at work and at home and everywhere else to watch Tiger Woods was not that unlike the way they gathered around the TV set in July of 1969 to watch a human being land on the moon. The idea that we wanted to be kind of witnesses to this event.
Performing astounding feats on a golf course may not exactly be one giant leap for mankind, but as he rehabs his injuries the rest of this season, fans surely will miss Tiger, and the business of golf will miss what's called the Tiger effect.
When he plays in tournaments, they sell more tickets. Ratings and TV go up sometimes twofold. Or threefold.
Charlie Kammerer is publisher of Golf Magazine and the website golf.com.
If you look at the five spikes we had in the first 4 months, all of them were related to Tiger.
Kammerer says the industry hasn't yet quantified how much will be lost. He says now it's up to the media to tell the great golf stories that haven't been told because of the focus on Woods. Only one story, though, is sure to generate buzz. When's Tiger coming back? Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Last week, we asked you to tell us how you're coping with the economic downturn, how you're dealing with high gas and food prices.
Well, close to 150 of you responded, and most of your letters described lifestyle changes, large and small. Here's a sample of what we heard. A few of you said that you decided to move closer to work.
Listener Brandy Gunn tells us that 6 months ago, she and her husband and their two young children sold their house in the country and moved 25 miles into Williamsburg, Virginia, in part to save on fuel costs.
We're used to a culture of people who are fine with driving everywhere, but we really aren't. And so we, between the expense of it and time lost and fuel consumption, we decided to move into town. So it meant that we gave up a house in the country that we loved with a neighborhood that we adored. But we, you know, now we have the time with each other and our gas bill is a lot lower.
How much lower?
Let's see. We were spending anywhere between $180 and $230 in gas per month. And now spend about $75.
That's a big change.
It's a huge change. It makes a lot of difference.
Now, how are you getting around if you're not using the car so much?
Well, we actually use, we've got this double jogger that's kind of tired and worn by now, but we pop the kids in that. So if I go to the library, for instance, which is about a mile away from the house, they kind of, you know, eat snacks or read books on the way. And we've got a grocery store that's right across from our apartment complex. We can walk there. If we decide to pop out for something in the evening, we ride the bike. It's very convenient. And Williamsburg is a really, really walkable town. So that's very, it's great.
That's Brandy Gunn.
Teresa Matola of New Albany, Indiana, writes this, I have inadvertently become a new American. I think a lot of people will be living like me soon. I lost my house and then my business in the downturn that isn't a recession. Shh, don't tell anyone. I had to sell my car. I moved my family to an apartment close to my work, and we get around by bike and bus. We are living completely within our means and without credit. It's very different, but surprisingly pleasant.
Craig Noonan of Lansing, Michigan, has made a number of changes. Like quite a few of you, he's biking more, anywhere within 10 miles of his home. He's also buying day-old bread and getting books from the library.
And next month I will be learning how to make bread, and I'll start fishing as well to supplement my food.
Where are you going to learn how to make bread?
I actually looked up a couple things on the internet. And I've got two recipes that seem easy for first-timers, so it'll be a bit messy, I'm sure, but I'm hoping for the best.
The things that you're doing differently now, was the motivation sort of global? In other words, these are good things to do for the planet, or was it really economic that you were realizing that, that your budget was pinched?
It was economic, kind of feeling helpless in terms of rising gas prices, which means rising food prices, and just seeing it as a vicious circle and what could I do? And I wanted a little bit more control than I felt I had.
You said something in your email to us that, that caught my eye, and that's you wrote, "I enjoy more now that I'm forced to slow down."
Oh, yeah. It was a terrific thing that I discovered. Riding to work, I realized how frustrated I was getting from the drive into work. And after I started feeling that, I was like, well, what would happen if I walked to the grocery store? How, you know, and I get there and I'm not as rushed and I enjoy the process more. And I was really surprised. It was a benefit that I didn't expect.
That's Craig Noonan.
Here's how Rebecca Keppen is coping in Ignacio, Colorado. She writes, "Since I work from home, I'm limiting my trips to town to 3 days a week. I've decided I don't need a shower every day. Every other day will do. I'm getting serious about my veggie garden and buying a freezer to put my summer's produce in. I'm buying less expensive cuts of meat and eating more beans."
In Renton, Washington, Karen Fuller is also cutting back on her food bill. She has two children, ages 10 and 11. The family gets free food through a local cooperative gleaning program, food left over from stores or restaurants.
It's mostly produce, fruits and vegetables, but occasionally we get milk. Sometimes we get mystery cans that are just not labeled.
Oh, and don't know what's inside.
Right. It's really fun. You never know what you're going to get, and it improves our diets because, of course, fruits and vegetables are expensive, but also we're kind of forced to try new things and deal with that. So at first my kids were like, what is this, from the gleaners? And I said, yeah. But they've tried all sorts of stuff.
You have two kids who are 10 and 11.
Uh-huh.
How do they feel about all of this? Are they asking for things that you just can't afford to get them? There's so much peer pressure with things and stuff.
Yeah, it's a daily battle. Their friends have things. They see things that they want, and they want to go out to eat. We used to go out to eat about once a month as a regular thing, and we don't anymore. And the basic answer is, I'm sorry, we can't afford that right now.
That's listener Karen Fuller.
Listener Steve Hill of Redwood City, California says, I would say the impact on my wife and me is probably on the low side of average. We seem to be Luddites about many things. Our home computer is still gasp dial-up. We turn off lights when we leave a room. We watch very little TV. These are the habits of a lifetime which come from parents who either lived through the Depression or told us that if we couldn't pay cash for it, we probably could do without it.
Finally, we'll hear from 21-year-old Erica Garcia. She lives with her parents in Sun City, Arizona. Her family has a number of health-related expenses, and Erica has a 90-mile round-trip commute each day to her job as a data entry specialist. She remembers paying $20 to fill up her tank. Now she's paying almost $50.
We don't really buy groceries as much as we used to. We just keep, you know, certain non-perishables around. Like, I buy Michelinas, which are 98 cents each, and I eat two of those a day.
What are those?
They're like frozen lunches. They have a cheese manicotti that's not bad at all. And, you know, like little chicken nuggets and french fries.
So this is frozen food that you're heating up?
Yeah, in the microwave.
you said you're not buying groceries. Does that mean you're not buying fresh fruits and vegetables?
No, they're just too expensive. You know, no real meat or anything other than, you know, chicken when it's on sale is all we can really afford.
Do you miss those things?
I do. I really, really do. I mean, I used to be able to go and you know, have dinner at, like, a nice restaurant and not care if it was $20 a plate. But now it's like we go somewhere and I'm looking for the cheapest thing on the menu.
So you do get out sometimes?
We do. I mean, my 21st birthday, my family wanted to make a point of going out to dinner, but I mean, we were all self-conscious of what to order and such.
Where did you go?
We ended up going to, like, the Applebee's, which, I mean, I would have loved to go somewhere a bit more special, but, yeah.
When you look at what's going on, is there anything that gives you some hope right now, Erica? Things might get better.
Not really. I listen to NPR. I look at the news. Locally, it's, like, it's scary. I mean, we've heard that the buses can't even make pickups at some stops because they're so full now.
So many people taking public transportation.
Yeah, and public transportation out here, the infrastructure is not that good. I mean, you can't really count on it unless you spend 3 extra hours every day to get to and from work. So we're just used to taking our cars and going wherever we need to go. I mean, I just bought a new car, too. I mean, the reason why we did that is because I had an accident. Mm-hmm. So on top of the September medical bills, I had a car accident, broke my ankle, was off work, and yeah, it's just been one of those years, I guess.
That's listener Erica Garcia in Sun City, Arizona. We heard from many, many more of you than we could include today. Our thanks to everyone who wrote in about how you're coping with the economy.
Growing concern over rising food and gas prices has many people asking whether a speculative frenzy is to blame. Is a new market bubble forming? Well, you can explore that question at npr.org. The impact on golf of Tiger Woods' knee surgery, and we'll hear from a sailor who powers her vessel by breathing. Those stories are coming up on All Things Considered.